This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt should say host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty in downtown Vancouver. So excited for today's guest. We've got Ryan Chen. He's a senior lawyer at Harper Gray in Vancouver. Friend of the show, really great lawyer. On today, talking about family law, specifically divorce, and how that ties into real estate ownership in BC. Really exciting conversation. And the third lawyer, I think, in a row, maybe, or close to in a row.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, two things here. One, yeah, we're talking cohabitation agreements, prenups, postnups, how things get divided, what you should consider at every stage of your life. And maybe most interesting for myself, at least, is the great wealth transfer. This applies to many people listening to this show, whether you're on the side of giving the wealth or on the side of receiving the wealth, how to organize that transfer when it comes to real estate to make sure that that money goes to the people you want and doesn't get caught up in a 26-month fling.
Yeah, and you know what? The divorce is not a nice thing to talk about, but I mean, let's be honest, it's half of the marriages out there roughly end in divorce. So this is, it's good intel for people out there. There's tons of takeaways. But before we get to the conversation with Ryan, Matt, we just had a podcast that we've had a ton of feedback on. It's called The Cowichan Decision Explained, what it means for Metro Vancouver homeowners. Of course, we had Sam Adkins on the program. Sam is a lawyer in Vancouver who specializes in Aboriginal law. Really great conversation about the Cowichan decision. We posted it on YouTube. We've had a few hundred comments already. Tons of feedback just in general. Yeah.
We just clocked over 9,000, Adam. We clocked over 9,000 views
comments
on that.
Oh, views. Okay.
No, yeah, views. This reminds me. So one thing we should say is our primary listenership is not on YouTube. We're
no.
Spotify and Apple Podcasts is actually our number one.
Where almost all of our audience.
Yeah, it's Apple Podcasts first, Spotify second. We kind of in and over the years dabble in YouTube. But we're not consistent in any meaningful way. This kind of reminds me of the time we dabbled in TikTok for about three weeks, and you went viral. Remember that?
Yeah, and the reason it was 3 weeks is because that's how long it took me to get off the couch from being in the fetal position after I got lit up in the comments so aggressively. But
what was the one comment? Trust me, bro.
Trust me, bro. Yeah. They didn't. Nobody tackled my appearance, which was nice. That would have been a blow too far. One blow too far. But you know what? It was
immediately canceled the account.
We had to cancel the account. I almost got out of creating content. It was a tough one. But this is a little different. This was a weird. The thing about YouTube, as I think a lot of people that are on YouTube realize, is the comments section is, what's the best way to put it, Matt? I wouldn't say it's the most intellectual dialogue you've ever seen.
Let's put it this way. I learned a couple things from the comments. One is, there's a really serious contingent of people in Canada that believe there's a globalist takeover happening as we speak. That's a part of the world that I don't really follow along too closely.
Right.
Sam mentioned the United Nations UNDRIP. I'm trying to think of what it actually is. United Nations Declaration of Rights.
Leave it for the geniuses on YouTube.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. They all, the comments, whether you're pro, negative, anti, whatever, UNDRIP is used, like clearly there's a world in which UNDRIP is being discussed ad nauseum and these guys are all getting fired up about it. That was something that was surprising. And last, you know, we usually have a fairly local audience. This one was definitely picked up by other parts of the country because I feel like the comments, there's a lot of comments that are not from BC, that's for sure.
Alberta, Alberta separatists were in there.
There's a lot of Alberta separatists. Somebody just wrote some crazy thing and he was from Hamilton. So it's just an interesting experience and one that, who knows, that account might be shut down by the end of the week. But I do feel like that was a great, we did get some great feedback from Trevor Coote wrote us, the CEO of BCREA, saying thank you for a measured conversation, which I thought was, I agreed. I think Sam was great. So yeah, check that one out. Yeah, that was content I think we can all stand behind. So
yeah, Matt, let's, before we cut to this conversation with Ryan, of course, we've got the segment that still remains nameless. I think you have a trivia question.
I do, Adam. I have a trivia question this week. The October stats came out. Sign up for the Live Wire on VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com and you'll get those delivered to your inbox. The market is not a lot of change there. I don't want to go into detail, but one thing jumped out at me and it's a fairly simple question, but one that I'm curious to see if you get. In the stats for single family homes, Adam, and single families outperformed definitely the condo market this year. That's for sure. But we're down in Vancouver in single family homes. We're down. They separated into obviously the west side of Vancouver and East Vancouver. Which market, the Vancouver west side or East Vancouver or Vancouver East, has performed better over the last year, the last calendar year, October 2024 to October 2025? The west side or the east side?
Overall.
Yeah. Overall. Which has declined less? Because I'll give you a hint, they've both declined in terms of the home price index.
Well, Matt, I'm going to go with...
But Adam, before we get to that, I want to highlight a sold listing. We highlighted one last week. We'll highlight another one as we're coming into November. This sold this week. We're so excited for the sellers. 306-2128 West 40th. Just sold at Carisdale Gardens. We've highlighted this one on the show before. It's over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Offered at $1.274,900. Two bed, two bath plus den. Beautiful home. Like I said, just so excited for the sellers. But let's get back to this trivia question.
Okay, Matt. So let's go back to the trivia question. So just so I understand here, you're asking, have prices come down more in the east side or the west side when it comes to the detached market in Vancouver over the last year? Is that what you're asking?
Exactly. Over the last year. Over the last year.
Oh boy. I think it's close, but I'm going to say that there's been a bigger drop on the west side. Only because the entry level, there's more entry level price points on the east side. That's my logic, but yeah, I could be wrong.
And the people moving through the market, right? Yeah, it's those families making the leap. Adam, I would have agreed with you. That's what I would have guessed. You are wrong, though, however.
Yeah, it's the west side.
Times, you know. It's the west side. The west side is down 3.6% over the last year. Get this, the east side is down 7.5%.
Wow.
East Van is actually doing worse than a lot of markets. A lot of markets, if you look at the single family detached specific of stats. The one thing to note though, Adam, you're an East Van guy, that's how you identify, right? As an East Van guy. Over the last 5 years, East Van is 17.6% up. Whereas the west side is up 6.7%. And of course, on the 10-year, East Van is basically quadrupled, 44.4% up, whereas the west side is up 10.7%. But over this last year, I would say it's pretty clear. The west side has weathered the storm better than East Van.
Wow. Interesting. So yeah, that's very interesting. I wonder right now, and I mean, this is a question that we've talked about on the show before, but at what point do home prices on the east side get so expensive or the gap narrow so much that the west side just looks like a better opportunity for people? And I think we're probably seeing that this year. I mean, I think a lot of a lot of price points have leveled out in certain sub areas of the East Side and West Side, right?
You know what? Actually, it's a what goes up must come down kind of logic. I feel like the West Side was depressed when East Van was still ripping, right? Or depressed might be strong, but not seeing the same appreciation. So you're right. Maybe there's that's actually a smart off the cuff take. I like it.
Well, without further ado, Matt, let's cut to this conversation with Ryan Chan.
Enjoy.
Attention realtors, homebuyers, and investors. If you missed out on Atlin at Clayton Crest by Zentera Developments, here's your second chance.
Atlin sold 80% in just 3 months, Adam. And because of that success, Zentera is launching Building 2, Butte.
Located in West Clayton and walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, prices are still low for now, but not for long.
Homeowners across the Lower Mainland are using equity from their current homes to invest in West Clayton, ahead of the SkyTrain and the next market upswing, because when that SkyTrain is complete and the market rebounds, it'll be too late.
This, Matt, is how wealth is built. Find out why Atlin sold so fast and register now at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown, and we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia,
serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakwin, please reach out to us at oakwin.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much. And we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
Okay, we're here with Ryan Chan. He is the senior lawyer at Harper Gray in Vancouver. How you doing, Ryan? Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, no problem, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Ryan, maybe to start, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
I am a lawyer at Harper Gray. I'll just do a little plug for my firm. It's we're one of the bigger litigation firms in BC. We're in the Scotiabank Tower, as you can see. Great view here. I practice primarily in family law, commercial litigation, and employment. So those are kind of the areas I dabble in. I don't try to venture out beyond that. And it's been a good run so far. I've been practicing for about 10 or 11 years. Pretty good stories to tell you. Some of them have to be offline, but that's a little bit about me.
Why did you want to? I know you cover a broad variety of areas in law, but why family law? What piqued your interest?
Well, you know, it's when I tell people what kind of like the areas I practice in, they're always confused. It's like, how do you actually work with commercial litigation, which is big companies suing other companies, breach of contract, all these other things, versus family law, which is, you know, the more human side of things. And that's probably the answer right there. I think it's a little more practical. Not everyone has a big corporation that they need to sue someone else. People are getting divorced. People are getting married, you know, so I guess it's called the circle of life of a marriages, I guess, for lack of better words. But there's a lot of opportunity for me to not only use knowledge as a lawyer in court and all that stuff, but a lot of outside alternative dispute resolution options. And sometimes you just got to be outside the box with your thinking. It's, there's a human side of it too. You're actually dealing with a person, and it's, to me, it's when someone comes to you at the lowest time, it's okay, they need your help. You need to kind of really, you know, show your empathy and really, you know, they trust you and they're not paying you to just kind of sit around and listen. You have to actually have some solutions. So I think that that's kind of a privilege. And I've always appreciated that a human aspect of family law.
You know, it strikes me that there's some similarities in what we do, Ryan, no offense, but, you know, not necessarily that people are buying properties at their lowest point, but it's a very stressful moment in somebody's life. You know, when they're purchasing a large asset or potentially the largest asset they'll own, and you're kind of, you know, the common refrain in real estate is, you know, your therapist, your negotiator, your, you know, blah, 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 how important you are. But in your practice, I would imagine navigating those relationships at, like you said, often the lowest point is probably really challenging.
Yeah, I would probably you know, again, to full disclosure to the audience, my first home, I actually purchased with the help of a Matt Scalina. So I remember going back and forth saying,
point. That was your high
point. Yeah, at a high point. I remember saying, oh, Matt, is this a good deal? are you sure? And I think I'd almost ask it in 10 different ways to make sure, are you lying to me? Is this a good deal? Is this not? But yeah, in family law, again, in both sides of it, it's a big deal, regardless if it's a negative or positive. People are getting married. And I always tell people, this isn't an insurance policy. You still have to try your marriage. This is just protecting very specific parts of your assets or your wealth. And yeah, we provide a service. I can't tell you what to do. I can only provide you with the landscape, the different options, the risks, and we try our best. But I remember, from my earlier days as a lawyer to now, I do kind of dabble more of, well, this is what I would do. Or you do start giving them a little more guidance than just the straight black and white law. I think that's just the maturation of myself as a lawyer. But it's, you know, when you see someone, and I remember when you gave me the keys and all that stuff, it was a pretty memorable day. But there's been times in my career where you kind of get them through this hard time, regardless if it's a prenup or a divorce. And there is some satisfaction knowing that this person goes, oh, wow, that was really nice of you to do that, or that was a great job, and I'm really happy now. And sometimes I get emails and even Christmas cards, and it's, you know, it definitely makes the day go easier for a hard job.
Perfect. So Ryan, when couples are buying property, I mean, the last thing they're probably thinking when they purchase together is that a divorce is potentially looming. What are some of the key things that all couples should be thinking about when they buy real estate?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, probably the most applicable now. For full disclosure, I'm a big romantic. I hope everyone lasts together forever, but I wouldn't have a job if that's the case. So, you know, when everyone is hot and heavy and they're in love in the honeymoon phase, no one thinks about, oh, what happens if I get a divorce? And they pay me to say, hey, I hope you guys do make it, but just in case, these are the things you need to think about. And the biggest one is money. Like, everything comes down to money in terms of the disputes. You know, if you have a couple that's buying a property, where is the money coming from? Who's putting in the money? Who's going to be paying moving forward? I think if we take a step back, the biggest misconception I've heard, at least, is that, we've only lived together for X amount, or we're not really together, or whatever. The law isn't as black and white on that. And to be clear, it's 2 years for common law, which is very akin to a marriage in terms of property rights. So if you were to contribute funds into buy a house, you know, the law treats it differently depending on where you are in your relationship, as well as, you know, what happens down the road. So I think that if you're thinking about buying a house as a couple, and this isn't someone owning a house and someone moving in, buying a house as a couple, I think this best is to say, well, where is this money coming from and how we're going to deal with our finances down the road and have a clear idea. Not the most romantic thing, obviously, in a new relationship, but, you know, just obviously just documenting it in some manner, shape, or form. Conversations are very hard because then it comes to a he said, she says down the road. Having just any kind of written record of this is what I would advise.
And so, does it actually matter if you have documentation? Okay, you know, we've been together 3 years, we're buying a home, I'm putting in $60,000, she's putting in $40,000, I'll probably take care of 65% of the mortgage costs, she'll take on 35%. Like, actually spelling that out, if something goes sideways in the future, does that matter? Or is it just kind of 50-50?
Yeah, I think I kind of get where you're coming from here. So, you know, without getting into like the deeps of in the weeds of family law here, first of all, the law does protect you. I'm going to use some terminology here. Hopefully it doesn't go over your guys' head. It's family property and excluded property. Those are the two things we need to worry about. So excluded property is anything that came in from a third party, a gift from mom or dad, an insurance policy for, you know, a motor vehicle accident, or, for example, something that you owned previous. So those are your contributions. So let's say that the man gets $60,000 from dad, the wife gets $40,000 from someone else, another relative, and you put that in together. You know, the law would say, yeah, sure, $60,000 excluded, $40,000 excluded for the other party. And when you are to sell the property, let's say under the circumstances of separation, in terms of the equity, you know, they would get their portions back and then split the rest. But that's just in a hypothetical perfect world, right? Things happened. People remortgage. Some people say, well, I spent $60,000 for the mortgage or the down payment, and I'll spend another $50,000 for renovations. There's a lot of different factors. And, you know, the law does provide it by default, but remember, the law is based on evidence. So you then have to prove it. You have to prove the intention. You have to prove what actually went through bank statements and all that fun stuff. I'm using fun facetiously, obviously. So having a record of it just makes it so much easier than having to pay a lawyer $500 an hour to go through that paperwork, to build that argument. If you have this agreement, it's clarity and it's some bit of certainty, at least on that specific instant or transaction.
And Ryan, you kind of hinted at it before, but how does the law treat married couples versus those couples that are just living together when it comes to property rights?
So that's a pretty loaded question, but the simplest answer is that if you reach 2 years together as a common law couple, you're cohabitating in a marriage-like relationship, at that two-year mark, you are considered to be common law. And your rights crystallize as akin if you were married. But the interesting thing about that, and this is a really bad family law joke, so please laugh at this, Matt and Adam. But if you're in a relationship, a common law relationship, and you're kind of unsure, and you're at 23 months, maybe time to separate. Because what happens there is that on, and I'm not using exact numbers, but on the 24th month of you guys living together in a marriage-like relationship, your rights crystallize retroactively. For example, February 1st, 2024, you guys start, or the couple that we're talking about, or this hypothetical couple, gets together, starts living in a common law relationship, February 1st, 2024. 2 years down the road, it's February 1st, 2026. That's 2 years. Anything that they acquire in the 2 years previous, the rights crystallize. So there would be claims for property entitlement to anything that was accumulated in that 2 years leading up to that common law mark. So anything that you purchased, that you acquired from February 1st, 2024 up to February 1st, 2026, it's as if you were married on the first day you guys get together. But if you were to separate on the 23rd month, there's different claims for, you know, unjust enrichment. But in terms of family law aspects, that's kind of the sticking point. So whenever someone comes to me and goes, oh, we want a prenup, or, you know, we want to separate or whatsoever, I'm like, how long have you been together? Like, really, how long have you been together? And then, not to go into the weeds of this, but, you know, if you start talking about, well, we were together, but we had our separate properties. We you know, he rented this, he has a house there, and I live here. But if you're spending every single day together, there's also an argument that you're actually living together, right? So again, there's a lot of things we can talk about. I don't want to go into the weeds. I don't think we have enough time for that. But 2 years, that's the thing you need to take away from that. Be careful at the two-year mark.
There are a lot of people out there doing mental math.
Yeah, exactly.
So Ryan, just at the two-year mark, I just want to understand. So if two people meet, they have they're, you know, at a point in their life where they've acquired a decent amount of wealth each separately. They're together for 2.5 years. Over that time, they accumulate, let's say, $200,000 in excess, and they split, you know, 26 months into the relationship. It's that, it's just that amount that they acquired together that is on the table. There's no, the stuff that was acquired previously, you know, it's not fair game to go after that.
Well, you know, here's a better example, and I'll use your numbers. So you've got give me some names here. Let's say John and Sally. I don't know why that makes me a little dated to say those names, but anyways, John and Sally, they get together, and Sally has, you know, an apartment in Yale Town, Matt, you're the king of Mount Pleasant, so we'll talk about Mount Pleasant. So she has a house in Mount Pleasant. That's an inside joke between me and Matt there. But so let's say that Sally has a house in Mount Pleasant. Her equity is $500,000. She meets John, whatever, dating, and they're not together. But as soon as, you know, like, they're living back and forth, they have their dating. But as soon as John moves in, we'll count that as day one, okay? And then they last for 26 months. So as of day one, Sally's house is worth $500,000, okay? And let's say it goes up to, in the 26 months, it goes up to $750,000. Oh, let's say 800, that's an easier number, okay?
Sure.
So minus mortgage payments, minus anything else, appreciation in the property, let's just keep it really simple. You had a $500,000 asset at day one, 26 months later, it goes up to $800,000, and then they split, okay? So how would you divide that? the law would say, first you pay off all your mortgages and all that stuff. You sell the property, let's say. And now that there is $800,000 in equity, what would happen in this case, again, this is a very simple example. Sally should get her $500,000 back as a claim, as her excluded property. The increase in value of her excluded property, remember it went from $500,000 to $800,000. The $300,000 is your family property, which you would divide in half. So when you walk away, John gets $150,000 and then Sally would get $500,000 plus $150,000. Now that's just the basic of it. But there's also another thing, and I don't want to get into too much of this, but you can see that I'm like kind of keeping it narrow, is that there's reapportionment claims, meaning is it really fair after 26 months that John gets half of it? He gets half of the $300,000 uptick based on the market or whatsoever. There's plenty of arguments of reapportionment. Maybe that should be 60-40, 70-30. Again, that's just down the road. So that's the basis of excluded property and division in property.
So Ryan, what about cohabitation?
I'll let that sink in for you guys first.
Yeah. What about cohabitation agreements? Like, can you walk us through what that means, and then also like when somebody should consider getting one?
Yeah, that's a common question I get a lot. You know, that's the first question I say is, how long have you been together? So if you're, it's always better to do these before the 2-year mark. The reason why is you're not really giving up anything for any party, right? You're not in a common law situation yet by law. You are, you know, you're 20 months in, you're like, hey, we're getting close, we're getting pretty serious, and we just want to protect our assets. So yeah, I'd say it'd be great to do that because you're not giving something up. You're not giving up rights that you already have crystallized, say in 26 months. But that doesn't mean you can't do it after. I have done cohab agreements or even, you know, post-nuptial agreements for parties that have been married for 2 or 3 years even. We just date things retroactively. You know, it's not fraud. We're just saying, as of this date, the parties agree that this is what happened. We bought a house. The house was this. This person bought a cabin. It's actually a gift from my parents. And we just kind of deal with it. And the parties can agree to anything they want, anything under the sun, as long as it's fair and as long as, you know, it's clear. So that's kind of when you should do that. And people do get overwhelmed with cohabitation agreements or any of these kind of agreements because they're like, well, what about spousal support, which is something that, again, you guys aren't going to deal with here, but that's part of any relationship. What about the kids, if you have kids, and all those other things? And not to mention the limits of these agreements are what happens in 5 or 10 years. So sometimes a simple answer to this, as life unfolds for everyone unpredictably, is that we do a very specific property agreement, meaning John and Sally got together as of this date. John and Sally had this amount of money before they got together. They've accumulated X, Y, and Z, and this is how they want to deal with it if they separate. It's a very finite agreement on very specific issues. And we say, we're not dealing with spousal support. We're not dealing with the kids. We're not dealing with anything else. Just, you know, 123 Carib Road, you know, 5-6 Drake Street and all those things. Well, I've just listed all the properties I've lived in anyways, but so let's go from there. So,
So Ryan, just to be clear, these cohabitation agreements or post-nups or whatever mm-hmm. agreements you're talking about, do they override like the law? Or how does that work in relation if somebody is upset and changes their mind or mm-hmm. wants to challenge these agreements? Are they ironclad or how does that work?
So nothing is ironclad. I hate to break it to the listeners here. And generally, people do honor the agreements they enter into. That's my experience. But I will never say that anything is ironclad, bulletproof. This is not the way the world works. So there's three things and anyone who's dealt with me in terms of agreements, I say the same three things. You need to have ILA, which is independent legal advice. I would act for one party and I'd send the other party to another lawyer to get independent legal advice. This way, the parties can't say, I didn't know what I was signing. I was signing under duress. You know, this was a wedding day the night before this agreement was thrown on me and I was stressed and all that stuff. That's the first bit. The second thing is full disclosure. You have to actually disclose all your assets because you can't actually waive something you don't know. You can't say, oh yeah, I don't want any of her property. I don't care. I don't need any of that. Well, if she has nothing, sure. She has $5 million in the bank and a house in West Van. Maybe you might reconsider that agreement, right? So those are the two things. But what you're talking about is fairness, which is the third prong of all this. Agreements need to be fair on the time of execution. We're talking about duress, the wedding day, prenup, you know, all those things, how it is executed, but also when it operates, when the parties actually separate. So if you have a young couple and they come and say, well, this is the house and it's, you know, the wife's and I don't care. And if we break up, she keeps the whole thing. Sure. I would say that that agreement has a shelf life of 2 or 3 years. But what happens if they have a couple of kids and the wife is really successful and the man just makes more sense to stay at home? And, you know, 5 years later, 10 years later, the agreement is 10 years old now and they separate and the guy doesn't have a place to live because the house is going to be hers. He hasn't put his money into the market. He thought we're together forever. He was so in love. He didn't work on his career because he was a stay-at-home dad. How is that fair? So that's the idea of when the actual agreement comes into operation. So the law is the level that is called significantly unfair. And that's why people say, well, this is clearly unfair. They didn't expect this. And that's how they challenge these agreements. And that's how they, you know, there's holes in it and say, well, this agreement should be thrown out and a judge can either replace portions of it or just throw the whole thing out completely. And that's a risk that I always advise all of our clients.
So I'm just thinking, is it worth or is it common practice to revisit these agreements like every 5-10 years with changing situations, or is that not something that's done?
In terms of updating your agreements, yes. I think that, you know, it's not every 5 or 7 years. We put review clauses in there, but I would say every so often, look at your agreement and review it. Your house that you've put on, that it might not even be there anymore. You might have sold that and bought a bigger house because you have 2 more kids. And there might be a mortgage and someone paid down the mortgage with a bonus check or whatever, right? Like, sorry, maybe not a bonus check because that's still family property, but inheritance from an aunt, right? Things change over the years. So I would always say if things, any big financial change or even life change, you have kids now, or someone took some time off work or has dialed back, retired, any kind of big life change, you should document that. Call your lawyer and just say, hey, this has happened since. We end up buying a new property based on refinancing this. And it might be that they say, well, no, that's fine. The agreement covers it. Or they say, well, you know, it's the penny wise, pound foolish saying. It's going to cost you a couple $1,000, but this cabin on Pender Island is worth $1 million. Do you really want to, you know, mess around with this? And the long and the short of it is that, you know, you're not recreating anything. You're just memorializing what's already happened. So the parties say, yes, this person put in X amount of dollars. We agreed this. So you're no longer going through emails. You're no longer going through text messages. You no longer have to say, well, you know, Auntie, she gave X amount of dollars, right? What if she's passed away? What if she's no longer able to say that, right? It's just, the whole point of this is to avoid litigation and pay the lawyer X amount of dollars on the back end, pay them a smaller amount on the front end just to kind of sort that through. So there's no question marks or surprises down the road.
So just to be clear then, Ryan, we live in a city where there's a lot of gifted money in the real estate market. So people mm-hmm. should be upfront when they're considering purchasing, identifying where the source of the down payment, for example, came from.
Yeah, that's you know, pretty much what I'm saying here. You always run into the situation with the banks where the banks go, is this a gift? Do you need to repay this? You know, again, I'm not trying to say that you need to misrepresent anything, but yes, it's a gift, but it's also, is the property under both names, for example? You know, that would say, oh, it's a gift to both of them. I think that it should be very clear, especially with no one can afford a mortgage on their own, right? It's always 2 people on title. The banks require that if there's going to be a mortgage under 2 people. It's always good to have some clarity of like, well, yeah, it's your both names are on title, but once you sell it, the first 50K, the first down payment or whatever goes to party A or B, and the rest is going to be split. That's how the law is. But again, you're only documenting it to just avoid all the back and forth, any potential conflicts down the road.
So it's as simple as that, though. The parents out there, and Adam alluded to it, that we're in, you know, a great wealth transfer that's kind of in at the start right now, and over the next 10 years is going to take place and kind of ramp up. If you're a parent gifting to a son or daughter who either is at that stage where they have a partner, or they're probably going to meet somebody in the next couple of years, it's just very clearly documenting that gift or portion of the down payment that you provided in order to make sure that that doesn't, you know, end up 50-50 out the door in 26 months.
Yeah, like I think that, you know, it's a timing issue, right? So if our hypothetical John, for example, is not with anyone and he gets a gift from his parents and it's under his name and he's by himself, there's no need to do an agreement. It's his, you know. We know the source of the money came from his parents, but at the time he meets Sally, he already has a gift for, say, a couple months. All it shows is that, you know, we have this, he has this property worth X amount of dollars, and that's a kind of a finite point in time. What we're really concerned with is if they buy a house together and money comes in from, it's almost simultaneously, right? Dad's giving money to John, John and Sally buy a house together, they go on title, right? It's all kind of one transaction. If there's a break in the timeline and the money came in a year before and it's just John living in a house and then he meets someone, we can actually put the value without saying where it came from. We don't really care where it came from. It's, you know, the best example is they're married and, you know, they have their first kid. Grandpa goes, oh my gosh, I'm so happy. I want to provide a better life for my grandkids. Here's $1 million. Go buy yourself a house. That's when we get to really big, like, well, let's just decide where this $1 million is coming from and how it's going to be characterized.
We've talked a little bit about this, Ryan, but prenups. What are prenups? They're obviously difficult things to talk about when you're considering getting married. Yep. When do they make sense and what should they cover?
Yeah, so a prenup and a cohab agreement, they're just different agreements for different stages of your life, right? Cohab is very pretty much short for cohabitation, which is the common law realm. And prenuptial agreements, nuptials, which is the marriage. So all we're talking about is just a couple that's hitting the two-year mark or about to get married. Interesting enough is that if you were cohabitating for a year and then you get married, your entitlement actually is the cohabitation plus the marriage. So just because you didn't hit the two-year mark before you got married, you're going to add that cohabitation time to your length of your marriage. Just not sure if anyone kind of caught that, but that's kind of interesting for property rights. People always go to me, oh, well, we only lived together for a year before we got married. I'm like, well, you kind of tagged that on. So any property that was acquired during that time, even though you didn't hit the two-year mark before you got married, will get wrapped into that property division issue there. In terms of, you know, there's a lot of couples out there that have children without, you know, getting married. That whole idea of the traditional family, you know, married, then have kids, all stuff, that might be a little antiquated, a little maybe even a little archaic now. So there's no real difference. You've always got the same basic things. For you guys, in terms of this podcast, it'd be obviously property rights. But just generally, you want to deal with spousal support. You want to deal with, you know, certain aspects of your life. We can actually include most things. I've included a dog and into one of these agreements before. You know, this was my dog when we got together and it loves me more. And, you know, I don't say that, but like, who gets a dog? So yeah, and we can do anything that relates to the party's relationship, except that it has to be fair. One thing that I strongly suggest for couples is that you kind of have to leave the children out of it. You know, without getting too far off track here, is that life is unpredictable. Kids, you don't know if they're going to do dance or hockey or both or whatever. Who's going to be doing parenting time? So we kind of cut that part out. Usually we try to keep it to property division and then spousal support. But again, like I said, with your first example, Matt, down before was, what's the shelf life on these agreements, right? You don't know what's going to happen in 5-10 years. We can't crystal ball that. You might have 5 kids. You might have none. You might have none, right? So it's hard to actually cover every aspect of our lives. We just do the best we can. And lawyers are very clear to say there's limits to our advice. What's your priority? The house. Great. What's the second priority? The cabin. Great. And the rest of it is kind of cherry on top if you can enforce that.
Ryan, I'll run something by you here because we have a lot of mom and pop
investors who listen to the show. So, you know, people that have acquired 2-3 properties, 4 properties, 5 properties over the years. So a couple divorces, they have no cohabitation agreements. They have no prenup. They own 3 properties. How is that usually handled? And I specifically thinking about they're both on title. Do properties, does it usually lead to a sale, or are there other ways to approach it? Like how, especially if there's some, it's an acrimonious breakup.
Oh, so you're talking about a separation here, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So let me get this right. So you have a couple and they have a couple of properties under their name, right? Okay.
Exactly.
So I'll add to that a little bit, if you don't mind. Let's say that there's a couple properties, but some are in individual names because they bought that years ago. Maybe some is a rental. So there's 5 properties. There's the family home, which is in joint names, but there's other properties in other people's names for various reasons. Okay. This whole 5 properties is still under the piggy bank of this is family property. It's subject to division. And then from there, we start dividing things and say, well, where was the excluded property? So if there was the cabin on Pender Island, for example, is one of the 5 properties, and that was actually inherited from grandma on the man's side, he'll say, well, we inherited that from grandma in 2015. At 2015, it was worth X amount of dollars. It's increased since then. It's 2026. So the amount at 2015 would be his excluded property. Any growth from 2015 to 2025, would be split as the family property. Just like my example of 500,000, 800,000, right? That's what we're splitting. And we do that exercise for all 5 properties. Whether it's, you know, from the wife's side, she's like, well, this was actually a gift from dad who gave me $100,000. Again, take the property, $100,000 out, the rest of it split. Now, you don't necessarily need to sell everything. It's just an accounting exercise. You look at all, you have the 5 properties, and then you just say, well, what's an equal split, including arguments of reapportionment and arguments of excluded property. And not to mention, you only get a capital gains exemption on your primary residence. So there might be issues of taxes and all that stuff to split. You know, if it's owned by a corporation, those are corporate assets now. You know, there's a lot of things that you need to think about in terms of how, we just can't divide it, you know, King Solomon style and just say, all right, it's half, it's fine. They're actually not the same. Then you start dealing with properties in the States. And you might say, oh, this house in California is worth X, but okay, exchange rate, first thing. But then how do you bring the money back over, right? How do you bring the money across the border? There's all these other things to think about. So that example is pretty loaded, but it's...
But I'm just thinking like, so say, let's just hypothetically say you go through, yeah, a brutally complex process to figure out, okay, this is, you know, John gets X, Sally gets Y. Is the process then, okay, John doesn't want to sell these, Sally wants nothing to do with John, so John has to either agree to sell them or buy her out?
Yeah, exactly. Well, okay.
If you don't have the funds to buy her out or get remortgage properties, it's basically you're selling them.
Yeah. And you know, part of that is the value too, right? You know, you think of it as just a little piece of, like in my boardroom, for example, I have a bunch of coasters. I say, we're trying to split them here and there. And there, it's just an image of that, right? But some people don't want certain things. Like if we get into like the more salacious issues, that's the house that you cheated on me with and with your whatever, right? I don't want that. And you're not going to keep it either. I want nothing sold. Again, there's millions of arguments out there. But in terms of value of these things, not to mention the taxes, just property in BC, you know, the worst is to use the BC assessment. I don't say the worst, but it's always 6 months late, right? Your 2026 is based off of, or your 2025 is based off of July 1st of last year. So those are always a little late. You have realtors, and I've called realtors before. I think I've called you before and say, hey, give me an estimate on this property. And sometimes clients don't want to spend the money. They think it's a pretty cut and dry. They just want a range from a realtor. So I'll call 2 realtors and just have a range. And if you want to go to like, you know, what the courts really like is they get an appraisal for a property. But again, it's just moving pieces on either side of the ledger.
Ryan, family trusts, we hear about them a lot. A lot of people probably don't really fully understand them and when they make sense. Can you talk a little bit about family trusts and when it's worth the complexity?
I don't want to give too much advice on this just because, you know, I know you have a lot of listeners here and I don't want to be saying anything incorrect, but, you know, trusts are very specific. They're a different vehicle for either tax purposes or transferring wealth. You know, I wouldn't just say, oh, it's in a family trust and it's protected. And, you know, too bad, so sad. All my money's in a family trust. Good luck trying to get that. It could be a roadblock, you know, for property claims to defeat them, but it's not absolute. Courts will always say, well, what was the purpose of this trust? Is it a sham trust? Like, is it just to defeat someone's claims? You know, without going too far into it, you know, you have a trustee, you've got a trust itself, and you have some beneficiaries. And, you know, depending on how the trust is set up, it could just be used for tax purposes. It could be used for, you know, making sure that only that wealth isn't, you know, dissipated foolishly or frivolously. But when it comes to aspects of a divorce, it's really hard to say, well, what's this person's interest in that trust? You have to go through the trust documents and so on. But I think for today's purposes is that you cannot say, well, it's in a trust, so I'm home free. That's probably the most I can say on a trust without getting myself into some trouble.
Right.
Ryan, I know my ears perked up when you said salacious earlier. Do you have a horror story or a cautionary tale or some story where you can change the names over your career that you've dealt with?
Okay. I can give you a couple, I guess. I have to change names and details, but well, my first advice in terms of just generally is invest in your marriage. That's the best investment you'll make because divorces are not great. So that's my first thing to say. I remember there was a issue with, this would actually be quite fitting as I'm thinking off the top of my head. You know, people are accumulating property. Before property was, you know, the hot asset, it was always just, hey, let's get as much as we can, rent them out. Obviously, you can't be primary residents on multiple properties. And, you know, so I remember there was a family, sort of the parties, I'll call them, that, you know, they did that. They accumulated a lot of wealth. And, you know, everyone wanted a piece of the action, right? Everyone was like, oh, great. You guys are doing so well. You own two properties and two houses and a couple apartments. You're renting them all out. You're making bank. And everyone wants a piece of this, right? So aunts and uncles start contributing. And they said, well, you know what? Here, take my money. I just put it towards something. And on both sides of it, right? So now you have all these properties, you have all this increase in value, and then, of course, they split up and everyone takes sides. Oh, no, that was a gift to that person only, and that wasn't a gift to you. Or you know, again, you can imagine the financial forensics to go through all this, to kind of go through all the layers. Now, of course, when you have a property, sell it because you want to buy something bigger. You know, the uptick, you see another good option, you remortgage it. So, you know, and the numbers of this was, I think there was like 15 or 20 different properties they had. And no one knows, you know, who owns this? Did the company own it? Did a trust own it? Where does the money come from? And who lived in it? Was it just for estate purposes? So one thing that people do is that they put, you know, for example, a bank account, they put in someone else's name, or if you put a joint title for just to bypass probate, it's just the right of survivorship, right? Someone passed away. It just goes to the person who's left over. And, you know, throwing out all those things, it was just like a nightmare to go through that. And I'll add another wrinkle to that, is that they separated, but they continued to live together for the sake of the children. And, you know, one party actually had more money, so they continued this investments, and they continued, you know, the formula of let's keep buying more property, buy more property. So the issue with that is that now you've got two issues. When do the parties actually separate? Because you deal with post-separation assets a little differently and post-separation contributions. So not only is when did the parties separate, so that was the first issue you had to deal with. There was a trial just on that issue. And then once you figure out the date, then you have to figure out unraveling, okay, so where did all this money come from? Who owns what? And if you want to make this even worse, is that once you figure out where all the property goes, what's everyone's income to actually figure out spousal support. So that was just the biggest mess in the world. So that if you want to say, maybe we should get an agreement done, think of that.
Also, yeah, they still have to have breakfast together, which seems even more incomprehensible.
You know, in that situation. It's on a more human side of things. People do certain things that you go, oh my God, that's crazy. But and when you get kids involved, obviously that most people say that's your first priority, right? The law even says that it's the best interest of the children is the paramount test. So, you know, some people do stay together for the kids, right? And in terms of separation agreements, on the flip side of things, when you're about to sell a property or whatever, or trying to figure out the end date, a very interesting thing that people don't realize is that because you can't live anywhere else, because rent's hard, because, you know, everyone's in a financial crunch, you know, this is not the common example, but even if you're in a one bedroom and, you know, you're even sharing the same bed, let's go to the extreme here, you could still technically be separated. You're just, for lack of space, still together. That's a very interesting concept that I kind of had to deal with, right? So just kind of little tidbits here and there. I see you guys get a chuckle of that one.
Yeah. No, that's great.
Yeah, well, no, I was just going to say one more thing because we did have Richard Bell on the show recently talking about estate planning, Ryan. And the general theme was that the young people don't start thinking about these things early enough in life. And it's not something that you want to leave. Is there a similar line of thinking when it comes to maybe not planning divorce, but for making sure that you're documenting your finances in your mind? Like, is this something that all people should be considering?
I would say yes and no. If you are a young couple that got together and you both have, you know, and I'm going to use this sensitively, like basically nothing. You know, you're out of school and you got some student loans and you're just living life, building, you know, the dream and working hard and then you get your first apartment and it's all pretty much equal. If you came to me, I'd say, no, don't waste your money. There's no point. You know, your claims are going to be what they are. There's nothing coming in. There's no like, oh, you need to do this. You know, everyone has to do a will. Yes, that's true. Not everyone has to do a prenup or a cohabitation agreement. It's only if, again, a certain transaction happens, a gift from a third party, money came in from a settlement, from an insurance claim or whatsoever, all those things, when there's something to fight about at the end and you want to say, this is a excluded property, that's when I would start thinking about that. But for the common couple, no, I don't think that's necessary. And people need to realize that you can do these at any stage. You know, just because you're married doesn't mean you can't do one a year later or 2 years later if you remember something. So yeah, if life was so predictable, it'd be great to get this done and just hammer all the things. But I would just do it on if it's necessary for, again, for the significant changes that happen in your life financially.
It makes a lot of sense. Well, Ryan, we do have this segment called the Five Wire Five Lighthearted Questions that we end every show with. Can you stick around for that?
Sure. I hope I give better answers than I have.
This podcast is sponsored by Jethro Condos in downtown Langley. Over 100 homes under $425,000 with one-bedroom suites starting at $399,900.
Here's what's incredible, Adam. These condos actually cash flow. When's the last time we could say that about new construction in the Lower Mainland? With these entry-level prices, the numbers actually work for investors.
And you're in the heart of downtown Langley, surrounded by trendy cafes, artisan bakeries, and parks. The area is experiencing incredible growth and new development.
Yeah, the location is absolutely key. Jethro is steps from the future Langley SkyTrain station. Get in before that transit connection transforms the area. Because once that SkyTrain arrives, you're looking at direct connections across the Lower Mainland.
Jethro is a Whitetail Homes project. Whitetail Homes has over 25 years of experience with quality construction and finishes that exceed expectations. We're talking vibrant interiors, expansive windows, and thoughtful design.
For realtors listening, they are offering amazing cooperative incentives. This is a rare opportunity where the fundamentals make sense. Affordable entry, cash flow potential, and positioned for major transit infrastructure, an all-around win.
Register at jethrocondos.ca. That's J-E-T-H-R-O condos.ca.
Jethro Condos, distinctly Langley, uniquely yours.
Question number one is one book that you've read recently that you would recommend for our listeners.
You know, this is going to be a really bad answer because I don't read any books because I read too much every day. So I'm going to have to pass on that one. Here's a little bit about me. So when I've been reading probably this one book for the last 10 years. I'm a big fan of, like, you know, the Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons. The problem with that is that these books are so loaded with different terminologies and references, is that as a lawyer, I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. I'm cross-referencing every page, and it's taken me years to get through this book. So reading is not, at least fiction, is not good for me. So I'm still on page, I don't know what I want to say, but I will tell you guys when I finish that book. So reading is fiction is not my strong suit. It's legal documents more than anything else. I haven't read a book in a while, to be honest.
Doesn't sound enjoyable.
Right. We can cut this part out, right?
In the last few years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life? And at least I know, Ryan, you're a big athlete, but I don't know if that has anything to do with. I don't want to load this up.
You know, doing family law, you definitely get a lot of perspective on certain things. You know, people don't come to my office going, "Hey, I got a divorce." It's a gradual process. It's, you know, I'm getting divorced. This is such a crappy time in my life. Oh, you know, I'm so better off without it. It's a very gradual thing. And not to make this all, you know, super warm and fuzzy, but I think for my life, as Matt, you know, I used to play, you know, like pretty high competitive sports and all that stuff, is I'm getting older. And, you know, like your focus has changed. I think the one belief or behavior or even habit that's changed the most is just being grateful. You know, I can still run. I can still play sports. I can still, you know, I have a pretty good job. Like, there's always gonna be someone with more or less. You know, we're all like, you know, we're all about the same age, I think. And now we're all looking at the kind of the second half of our lives. I'm less focused on, oh, I should have done this. I should have bought Bitcoin. I should have bought Nvidia or Tesla or whatever it is, and said, you know what, I'm still doing pretty good now. I'm grateful for what it is, and just looking forward to the next 40, 50 years and just trying to make the best of that and appreciating the journey. I think that's just being grateful, I think, is probably the thing I've learned the most.
It's a great answer.
I thought you were going to say pickleball.
People who know me and play pickleball with me know that I am a very enthusiastic player. We'll call me a diamond in the rough. We'll put it that way. We'll do an update next year.
Okay, question number three. What have you been binge watching lately, or a movie recommendation?
I don't watch a lot of TV. In fact, I don't have any subscription, to be honest, to any Netflix or any of that kind of stuff. But I do watch this one show, and I've watched it probably every episode since 2001. It's called Pardoned Interruption. It's a sports talk show with two guys. One is Tony Kornheiser, a 70-year-old Jewish man who grew up in New York, and a guy named Michael Wilbon, who's a big Chicago guy. He's an African-American descent. So it's you get the kind of the back and forth. They argue about everything, but there's like kind of a race aspect, a socioeconomic aspect, and just like they've lived it, right? They're like, oh, when Babe Ruth did this, oh man, not Babe Ruth, but they were there to actually give live commentary back in the day. So I find that show quite interesting. Movies, that's a hard one. Too Big to Fail, that's a good one. I'm not sure if you guys watched that, but it's about the financial crisis of everyone buying houses. It's along the lines of like The Big Short and what's that one with Margin Call, those movies. I'm a big Marvel fan, so Endgame was a really good one for me. That's kind of my time. And I'll probably finish off with Notting Hill and Fast and Furious.
I think I knew the Notting Hill was coming for some reason. Not surprising. You did say you're a romantic. Favorite band or music, Ryan?
Oh man, these are the worst. I should. Okay. You know, I'm a '90s baby, so like '90s, 2000s hip hop R&B is always going to be a soft spot for me. '80s love ballads, I'm a big fan. I did my trifecta. I think I told you about this, Matt. I finished. I went to Rod Stewart, Elton John, and Bryan Adams. So I went to all three concerts. So I finished my '80s trifecta. You know, I don't mind a little Taylor Swift here and there. I, again, anything really that kind of just you can bob your head to and kind of sing along. We should probably cut that part out too.
Our R&B and rom-coms, we better not give your contact out or else you're going to have you're gonna get a lot of DMs here. Maybe last but not least, something that you've purchased for under $1,500 that's had a positive impact on your life.
Probably my subscription to the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. We all pay $1,500 for this, right? That's what I understand, right? $1,500, you know, I'd probably say my flight to Japan at the end of the year. That was really neat. It's something that just kind of was a spur of the moment. And, you know, I had a little bit of a gap in my work that I just got up and left. It was very spur of the moment. And it was probably one of the coolest trips I've been on recently. So has it changed my life? Yeah, sure. We'll say yes. it was a good trip. So
we'll add one more
to Japan.
Highlight from Japan.
Highlight from Japan. There's this place in Nara, and I think it's in Kyoto, where you can, and whoever's been there, they know what I'm talking about. It's this deer, a reindeer park, where, or not reindeer, it's just deers, and you literally feed them, and they're so accustomed to people that they bow to you. So for some reason, I was just too eager and I was just jumping around trying to find a deer to talk to or to hang out with. And they all ran away from me. And then finally, this one deer kind of like, I guess, felt sorry for me and just kind of followed me around. So the highlight was just having this deer that followed around and was just great. Like it was just, oh, wow, we're like buddies now, right? And on that note, I also, I'm a big fan of capybaras. So I did go to a capybara cafe, which was kind of neat. So yeah, those were kind of neat. I did all the other touristy things like the, you know, the giant forest, the temple, the sumo wrestling, all that stuff. But I think the deer that, you know, I didn't get the contact information, but the deer that followed me around for 20 minutes was probably my favorite.
I would have never guessed bowing deer would have been the highlight of the trip.
Yeah. That's
I'm trying to separate myself from all the typical answers here.
Well, Ryan, thanks so much for taking the time today. If people want to get in touch, how can they follow along or reach out to you?
Yeah, no, again, anything that you guys want to talk to me about in terms of like legal related, I'm happy to chat about most things. But if you want to contact me for legal related stuff, you just go to our website, harpergrey.com. That's G-R-E-Y. And my email is rchan@harpergrey.com. I'm pretty easy to find. Ryan Chan Lawyer is probably the easiest way to do it. And then you'll find me. And then yeah, if there's anything they can help you out with, then I'm happy to chat.
Fantastic. Thanks again.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Ryan Chan, senior lawyer over at Harper Gray. Really enjoyed that conversation, Matt. Biggest takeaway for me, don't get divorced. Stay in it.
Invest in your relationship was what Ryan said.
That's
sage
a good one.
Advice. Sage advice. Or invest in your marriage, I think was the actual line. But but lots of takeaways. I feel like documenting things is, of course, just that first and foremost paramount in any relationship that's a little complicated. But lots to think about there, and super happy that Ryan took the time to speak with us. That's for sure.
Yeah, for sure, Matt. And before we cut for the day, what else do we have?
What else do we have, Adam? We have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is our website where all things real estate related live. Of course, we have PCS, which is our buyer's resource. Of course, we have the Sold Plan, which is our seller's resource. We send out the live wire, so you get on that list for sure. But what I want to say, Adam, is we're kind of moving this fall into really useful content, I think, for, you know, lots of takeaways, talking to really smart people. And if you're finding it useful, all we ask is that you like or review or share the podcast with somebody you think might get value. We're trying to grow as always. And we appreciate people helping that way. That's for sure. So that's our one ask for the day.
And Matt, if people want to get in touch with you,
you can try me at any time, 778-847-2854 or matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we got that nonpartisan Kokomo line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
We'll have a great week, and we're back here with another great episode next week. A couple people we're talking to, we've got a fantastic financial planner coming on the program who's going to talk about how to diversify with real estate and your stock portfolio and plan for your future and your retirement. We've got Professor Andrei Pavlov coming back on the show from SFU. I'm so excited for that. And we've got some other amazing shows coming up. So many great episodes coming for the balance of the year. So stay tuned.
Take care.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.